Hi, welcome to NSYNC, the podcast that explores the history and impact of some of your favorite music moments in TV and film. I'm your host, Rachel Brodsky.
And I'm Losing My Religion.
One of the most poignant films to come out of 2022, After Sun is a coming-of-age drama set in the late 90s where a preteen named Sophie and her father, Callum, played by Paul Mescal and Frankie Corio, holiday at a resort on the Turkish coast. Meanwhile, in the present day, the daughter, now an adult, pieces through camcorder footage to better understand what exactly was going on with her father on that vacation, which would be their last together.
In one of After Sun's most touching and brutal scenes, Callum and Sophie dance together on the last night of their holiday to Queen and David Bowie's Under Pressure, which is given a haunting remix by After Sun score composer Oliver Coates. Joining us to help break down this essential needle drop is Vulture film critic Allison Wilmore.
How did Under Pressure end up in this scene? Why was it given a dissonant remix? And what does it say about Callum, whom we mostly see through camcorder footage and Sophie's 11-year-old perspective?
All that and more on the latest episode of NSYNC.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Jumpstart your career at St. Clair's Health. Discover an amazing and rewarding workplace. St. Clair's in Denville, Dover, and Booton is now hiring RNs, LPNs, CT techs, social workers, and more. Join an award-winning network of community hospitals, receive a competitive salary, and experience a great place to work with supportive coworkers in a beautiful location. Check out the bonuses. Apply today at stclairs.com/careers. That's stclairs.com/careers.
Welcome, Allison. Thank you so much for being here with us.
No, thank you for having me. I will say, the last time I was talking about this scene to someone, I was like getting choked up. So be prepared for me to choke myself up just, you know, thinking about the tragedy and beauty of this needle drop.
Such an interesting scene because it, I mean, we're jumping way ahead, but this is kind of what the movie does too, where you get little bits of information about the scene throughout the film, and then suddenly it gets recontextualized in stark relief at the very end, and it feels like almost like some of the things that Christopher Nolan used to do when he was first, you know, on the indie film scene, which is like recontextualizing lines or moments at the end of the film to give you this like really big kind of frizzin. We usually start with me doing like a plot breakdown of the film, and this might be the shortest plot breakdown I ever get to give, considering Under Pressure plays in multiple contexts at the end of After Sun. In Scottish filmmaker Charlotte Wells's feature debut as a writer and director, 11-year-old Sophie, played by Frankie Corio, goes on vacation to a Turkish resort with her father Callum, played by Irish heartthrob and Gladiator II, Paul Mescal, if that movie is ever going to come out. The film is loose on conventional plot, at least in the hero's journey context. Instead, through Sophie and Callum's interactions, we learn that Callum has separated from Sophie's mother, and despite putting on a brave face and clouding his decisions with optimistic denial or mania, it's clear that Callum is extremely depressed. He tries to hide it from Sophie, but she catches his mask faltering several times throughout their vacation. It's the late 90s, early 2000s, and Sophie is filming everything on one of those mini DV cameras that families had at the time. Coincidentally, this was the type of camera that I started making films with as a teenager. Instead of just a stylistic device to tell us the time period and to cut down on budget, which it is, and a good one, we come to learn that what we're truly watching is adult Sophie watching her own movies from 20 years ago, looking back on maybe the last time she got to see her father. There are several formative moments on this trip beyond Callum's depression. Sophie meets an older boy named Michael, and there's some flirtation and attraction and a whiff of danger, and Sophie has her first kiss. There is an embarrassing yet redemptive moment at karaoke night in this resort where Sophie sings REM's Losing My Religion only to maybe figure out what the lyrics are about mid-song, a moment that always reminds me of Arrested Development. And that would be our song of the week, REM's Losing My Religion.
That would be a close second, I think.
It's a really good moment if it weren't for the final sequence of the film, where on the last night of their vacation, Callum and Sophie dance to David Bowie and Queen's collab Under Pressure. This first dance would be enough of a heartrending moment, but as Sophie and Callum bid each other goodbye on their final day, we break from our mini DV style and we cut to Sophie in the present day with a wife and young child, and we finally see adult Sophie, played by Celia Ralston Hall, and what has become of her in the present. A Turkish rug that Callum purchased in a moment of mania is hung prominently in her home, and then we cut back to Callum, still in the airport, and he heads to what we think is like an airport hallway, but it turns into a rave. A rave that we've inexplicably seen in Sophie's mind's eye throughout the film. And he's joined by adult Sophie in this liminal space, and father and daughter dance to Under Pressure once again. Only, this time that all the music drops out, and we hear the pure, unadulterated voices of Bowie and Mercury echoing as the characters dance.
With that, let's listen to a little bit of Under Pressure. Okay.
Turned away from it all like a blind man. Sat on a fence, but it don't work. Keep coming up with love, but it's so slashed and torn.
Allison, you talked about this film as your number one musical moment of the year 2022. Tell us a little bit about what you think makes this moment so special.
Well, I do want to pull back also to note that this movie has a soundtrack that is filled with some incredible era specific and also kind of like perfectly generic in an English way soundtrack. You know, it's filled with a lot of the kind of like pop detritus that you just would hear at like a, you know, a lazy wedding at the time.
A lazy
or
wedding.
A kind of like a cool store or, you know, a kind of budget vacation place like this. You got the Macarena.
The Macarena moment is also
that's a staple. I was expecting also to hear YMCA, which you could not escape from, even though it's a 70s song, but because the 90s were also the 70s.
Yes, exactly.
Pop culturally, I was like, where's YMCA?
Right. I know. I think you also, like, YMCA is one of those songs where, like, it doesn't have an era anymore, right? It is just now firmly cemented in just kind of the general pop culture awareness. But yeah, you've got, like, Aqua, My Oh My from Aqua.
Yeah, the other Aqua song.
Wasn't there also All Saints, wasn't it?
Yes.
All Saints. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. All Saints, Never Ever. Great.
I was actually really like trying my damnedest to suss out what exact year. I know they don't really say, but there are so many like 90s, like decade specific, but not quite like year specific, which is becoming like a bugaboo of mine. with films made now that portray them, because every year was so damn specific. And like, you probably wouldn't be wearing a dress from like 1994, which she was right. wearing, I feel like, because it was like the same kind of pattern and like over the white t-shirt kind of like spaghetti strap look. And then the daughter, I mean, and then we're listening to the Macarena. So I'm like, okay, maybe it's 1996. But then we hear All Saints and I'm just like, I'm lost.
Yeah. And you get like the Blur song Tender, which is like 1999, Tub Thumping, Chumbawamba.
Love
it's got
thumping.
Like an incredible, like, oh, and Catatonia's Road Rage. So there's a few songs in there. Like, my dad is from England, and so we used to go and hang out in like the far off edges of London sometimes over like to go visit relatives in the summer. And I definitely remember some of these songs that just never made it over here. Like Road Rage, which was like inescapable in like anywhere you went in the UK. And then like, I don't think they ever made nearly as much of a dent here, but you can hear that on the soundtrack too, which is like, this is deeply nostalgic for me.
Rachel and I are around the same age, and this feels, especially based on like how old we were when this came out, and this happens often now with the songs that we're like, this is not the first time we've mentioned this season. This feels like late 90s bar mitzvah core to me, because it's like the songs that I heard when I was going to these bar mitzvahs at this age, including All Saints, which was like the awkward slow dance song.
You know what, like the kind of sway.
Elbows
don't have moves
locked,
really, but
knees
you're like
locked.
I'm so close to this sweater. Other person.
Yeah, too close.
Yeah.
So yeah, the entire soundtrack is diegetic. It's mostly diegetic music, save for a little bit of this kind of liminal Under Pressure, which is very time and place oriented. And I have kind of a I wanted to talk a little bit later about the budget of this film, which appears to be around $3 million, and how much of that budget went to the soundtrack.
I know it's not like these are not cheap tracks, but like clearly like they're so like filling in some in like kind of memory texture, you know, in the director Charlotte Wells's mind. I bring up also the soundtrack choices because also like Under Pressure, great song, obviously, but is also the kind of song that you would expect to hear, you know, playing on the dance, you know, the dance floor at a cheesy resort. And I think there's something about that choice that feels perfect because it is both totally in line with the kinds of music that you've been hearing throughout the movie, but it is also just an incredible song with this soaring vocals and this soaring chorus, and it's so familiar. And I think all of those things become really key to the way it's used, because the first time we hear it, it is playing on the dance floor, you know, Mescal's character kind of like was trying to lure his daughter out, right? And you know, throughout the movie, we understand that like she's like right on the cusp of like teenagerdom, and meanwhile he's like someone who kind of failed to launch as an adult, and there's this way in which they're kind of like meeting in between. But so they're dancing at first to the actual song at like in a diegetic sense, and then when we get to that kind of dreamlike rave, it does feel like it starts to kind of dissolve until
both diegetic and non-diegetic.
Yeah. And you do get like one other bit of that. Like the Blur song Tender also has a moment, like when it bleeds over into the rave interstitial, and it has a bit of the same effect where the vocals warp a bit and it gets a little horror movie, it gets a little haunting. But yeah, I think that there's something about the deep familiarity of this song, like where you know it so well you can almost like don't hear it anymore, and then the ways in which it gets warped with both the vocals getting isolated and then like a little bit of the score kind of like getting in there as well, where it goes from being this like really warm moment to being a really kind of sad and like distressing moment, you know, when you see adult Sophie almost like hugging her dad in the memory as a kid on the dance floor. And then in this kind of liminal space, she's like almost like just trying to hold on to him. It's like she's almost like wrestling him, trying to get him.
She's playing back. She's wearing whatever that thing is from Strange Days, where she's like experiencing, trying to live within the memory. And they teach us a little bit of the language of that or like how they're using the song with the Losing My Religion cue, right? Where it is this other song where it's so familiar, we don't hear it, as you said. And then Sophie becomes like almost like Garden of Eden, acutely aware that everyone's looking at her and that the song's lame and I don't like it and I don't want to do this. She's 11 years old, yada, yada. And then he kind of redeems that moment and they sing it together. And you, and it functions kind of similarly to the way that that Under Pressure does at the end, which I think is an interesting, like they're setting up an interesting language of how these two appreciate each other.
I think both those songs lyrically are in could be in conversation with each other as well,
because for sure
they indicate something's ending and something's being torn apart. And that I actually never really thought about Losing My Religion quite in this type of like in a parental, like a familial context. Because mm-hmm. In college, I used to play it all the time and think of some, you know, some boy who didn't call me back or something. Right.
Absolutely. And in and of itself, it's about like having sex and that kind of like a thing that you don't want to talk about in front of your dad.
Yeah. And I think like with both of these songs, like neither of them is of the era that an 11-year-old would at the time, right, be listening to. And so you get also that sense of like, these are songs that she was introduced to through the adults in her life. Yeah, which of course, like that's absolutely, especially when you're that age where you haven't yet begun really, like your whole taste in new music hasn't fully cohered yet. Yeah. And so both of them, I think also like as music choices work in that way as well.
I do like though how, I do remember distinctly in the mid to late 90s, karaoke just being everywhere, kind of like how roller skating was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And hell, I mean, now you go to a karaoke bar and or maybe someone breaks out the karaoke at a party. But I just remember like I do really like how was that triggered some 10-year-old karaoke memories for me. Also unpleasant for different reasons.
We also have you and I, Rachel, have like a weird context with karaoke because we both live in Los Angeles, and going to karaoke in Los Angeles is like the first round of American Idol. Like people think that they're going to get discovered. Yeah. And so going like, you know, going back to where I grew up in Pennsylvania and doing karaoke is like much different. And it still feels kind of like that. Like this moment in the film where it's like people are just kind of there, they're making asses out of themselves for fun. They know that they're not maybe not a good singer. They take on what the Callum point of view is.
Yeah. Oh man, it's also like I never want to do karaoke with people who are just there to
who
show
are good.
Off there. Yeah. I'm like, I can't sing at all. I'm like, that's not fun. Yeah. If you can really sing, you should do something super goofy at karaoke. I feel like that should be understood to be the rule.
Are
right?
you in New York, Allison?
I am in New York, yeah.
So I feel like it would be a similar thing of like all these Broadway people understudies being like, it's my time to shine.
I think you can definitely, there are places where you can find all of the people who have like, you know, a deep well of musical theater love in their hearts.
It's less pervasive than,
you know where
than in LA.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah. But I think also you can avoid it if you know.
You don't, like in New York, there's like a place for everyone. And like that can be, it's like you can find your version of a TikTok feed on like a street.
My favorite karaoke spot ever is in New York. I can't remember the name of the bar, but it was in the back room of a bar that looked like a high school gymnasium. And it was run by this dude named Precious Gorgeous. And it ruled. It was the best karaoke I've ever been to.
Yeah, no, there's some good spots. There was one that was just in, I don't know if this is still open. It was like in a couple's living room over in East Williamsburg where they just, I think, were like accidentally zoned commercial. So you could like book their living room. And I will say that one time I was visiting friends in Branson, Missouri, because they were shooting a documentary there. And the karaoke scene in Branson, Missouri, I think blows all, rips. Even like Marie's Crisis in New York, like all of the kind of musical theater places away. Everyone there would just come out and just like belt out something incredible.
That rules. And
wow. Branson, Missouri, awesome.
There's a lot of straight talent like rattling around here.
That's awesome.
I want to explore this song a little bit more kind of lyrically. So Under Pressure, we can say textually, right? Callum is under pressure of his depression, and he, like, you know, Sophie finds him like crying in the bathroom at one point, which is really hard. And Paul Mescal is so good as this, like, well, he's an Irish dude hiding his feelings. So I would assume he's had some practice, but there's also this kind of like equality in the song, right? Cause it's a song with two lead singers singing back and forth to each other. So even though Under Pressure could be in conversation with Losing My Religion, Under Pressure itself is a conversation between, and it could be between Sophie and Callum as well.
Right.
But she's not aware of the conversation that's being had in the moment, really.
Yeah, maybe until the very end, or maybe never at all.
Well, I think as an adult, she does become aware, obviously, like, because she's like trying to figure out her father and access memories of him. And 11, I mean, assuming that he dies within the next year.
Yeah. Assuming that he dies at all. We actually don't know that he dies.
Yeah. It's strongly implied.
Yeah.
We never get, like, almost, right? Like, no information is, like a hard, like, declarative in this movie. It's all just on the sides.
That's one of the brilliant points of this movie is, like, none of the three of us watched it together. And yet we all know that Callum probably ended his own life within 6 months or a year of this vacation, even though there is no specific evidence to
yeah, it's other than him walking into the ocean / standing on the balcony, looking like he's...
Honestly, I thought he was good. I thought that was the end of Callum.
Yeah,
I did not think he was coming back.
He also, like, and I wasn't, the first time I watched the movie, I didn't quite pick up this timeline, but like after she has everyone sing happy birthday to him, we get that glimpse of him crying.
Oh,
and
my
I think
God.
It's supposed to be from that night. When he walked into the ocean, and you see, like, he's written a card to her that says, like, you know, dear Sophie, I will always love you. Mm-hmm. It feels very much like he was considering, you know,
yeah, I think
like
that's ending, what he was doing. Yeah, like, ending his life the night that she went off and had her first kiss.
And so, like, you know, I think it's a good reason to believe that it is very much on his mind, you know, and that it is something he's been thinking about pretty seriously. I will also say something I love about the choice of this song is that it is like painfully on the nose at certain points, right?
Yes.
Like, this is our last dance, you know,
and family, like, is being torn apart.
Exactly. Like, it's so
give
literal,
love just
but
one
I think
more
that,
chance.
Like, yeah, like there's something about that is so great, right? Like the best part about a kind of pop song can be just like how much it just leans into what it is about. And I think, like, in this case, the kind of elliptical nature of the movie with like this it's incredible directness of the way the lyrics line up, it just works so well.
Yeah, it could be too on the nose, but it works. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like Charlotte Wells is hiding it at all, because she's saying, I'm making you listen to this, exactly what they're saying, no other instruments, like, listen, I am going to being so on the nose. And yeah, why does it work? Because nothing else is on the nose, maybe. We're like waiting for the answers to the question of this relationship for so long, and this is what it gives us.
I have a question for Allison. I don't know. I don't know if you know this. I feel like I should know this. So I know that people get around, filmmakers get around royalties. Licensing, I mean, when they get like a cover of a song, or if they maybe they chop it up or they remix it, like that does change the number figure. Do you know that, like, is this an example of a way, like the way that the song is remixed and like certain, like the vocals are isolated and then some of the movie's own score kind of makes it in. Do you think that changes how much money they needed to pay just to get the rights to it?
I think it might have made it harder, actually, because you do hear the track in itself at first, and then you get just the isolated vocals and it's remixed. So I think, like, I've read a bit about like Charlotte Wells talking about this song, and like she has implied at a certain point that it required like the work of like multiple, like in addition to the you know, different producers and people they had working to like do the remix of like different people to get the rights.
Yeah.
The thing that I thought was so funny about this, the use of the song, is that you talked about multiple times how it wasn't originally, she kind of brought it in to be like, let's try cutting it. This scene, this is a song, you know, well-known song. Let's just try cutting it to this, which of course they always tell you not to do, right?
Never
as
do
a
it.
Filmmaker, yes. Because you'll get too attached to this music that you don't necessarily have the rights to. But they did manage to get the rights here. But yeah, I think it was like kind of a lark for them to be like, why not? Let's try this incredibly famous song. And then it just works so well.
It's really amazing. I think if there's a common theme on things we say about how a song ends up in a scene or movie, we usually start with, well, you're never supposed to do this, but
yeah.
Director X or producer Y
or music supervisor
Z, they wanted this song. In this case, it's a little bit more like they kind of tiptoed up to the song, but that seems to be such a through line, like in every super successful moving needle drop that we've talked, not all of them, but a lot of them start out with like the cart before the horse in terms of
the impossible the dream.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you really have to hand it to the directors and music supervisors.
I also have to imagine with a scene like this, where the music is used so prominently, the goal is to just get them to watch it. The only thing that you need to do, you don't need to ask them anything, just get them to watch it and they will understand, right? And in that context, you know, it's still an ask, right? You're still like trying to get the whoever runs the Bowie estate and whoever runs Freddie Mercury's estate to like give you their time. But it is such a powerful moment that like, as opposed to like the All Saints song, where it's just like, write me a check. Right, like I don't care whether or not my song is in this movie. You don't ultimately care whether or not my song is in this movie. Write me a check. There was a pretty famous example of this with a short film called Thunder Road, which was turned into a feature. And the director, director and writer and star Jim Cummings, put Thunder Road, the Bruce Springsteen song, into his short film. The short film is entirely based around the song, and he titled the short film Thunder Road. And he's just like, well, I really fucked myself on this one and got it in front of Springsteen or Springsteen's people. And he was just like, great. If you can move the artist, you know, artists are artists. If you can move the artists, I think you can get what you need.
Yeah, I was reading some interview about a little bit about the music choices, and one other thing that got brought up was when they were trying to get Tender, the Blur song, I think it was the music supervisor who had dated Graham Coxon, the guitar player, for like years and years ago, and she was like, well, if I need to, I can call on that. So they didn't. So yeah, I think sometimes you really have to be like, what are the strings?
Yeah, call your exes
to make you know, this famous person like this use of music.
Work that network.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Fargo, the new virtual assistant from Wells Fargo, makes banking faster and easier. Like this.
Fargo, what's my checking account routing number?
And this.
Fargo, turn off my debit card.
And this.
Fargo, what did I spend on groceries last month?
And that's just the beginning. Do you Fargo? You can. In the Wells Fargo mobile app. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/getFargo.
Terms and conditions apply. Your mobile carrier's availability and message and data rates may apply. Wells Fargo Bank NA, member FDIC.
You brought up an interesting thing, Allison, that the music really like dates this. I mean, both of you, Rachel and Allison, you both talked about the music dates this so specifically. And I want to talk a little bit about the device of the mini DV camera as well, I can't remember who said this to me, but I like it's like etched, lodged into my brain now, which is that time periods are remembered by their imperfections. And so when we were in 2000 shooting on mini DV cameras, as I was like, damn, this sucks. I wish that this was 24p and 1080p and perfectly global shutter and all this stuff. And now, and I would never watch a single thing on a mini DV camera because it looks so fake. And now, you know, 20 years removed, 24 years removed, it has this warmth, this like evocative style now, and it's only through the imperfections of the time that we could look back upon that. And I'm wondering if that can also be applied to Under Pressure. Like, what about Under Pressure puts us in a certain place and time? What about the production of it? What about the composition of it?
Well, I think, you know, you obviously have like these two enormous, like, outsized talents and people in Freddie Mercury and David Bowie, and like them coming together, you know, is in itself this incredible moment. But the thing that I learned about the song, which I did not know at the time, was like that, I mean, it makes sense, was that like Queen, you know, despite being massively successful, you know, they were deeply uncool for a lot of people.
Yeah, they were dorks.
Rolling Stones called them like a fascist band. Like they, you know, like they were maximalist and a kind of and there's a certain uncoolness to that, right? And so like that kind of melding also of like David Bowie, who is like never not been cool, and you know, and Queen, and it's shocking how well those things work. Like they're kind of like the things that they bring meld together, even though when you think about that, like the kind of type of music, you know, you might associate with both of them, it doesn't necessarily feel like, and especially apparently they'd like recorded it, like David Bowie, who really, I think, was perhaps a little difficult to collaborate with. Insisted that
there were some
like,
egos involved.
David? Yeah, you know, yeah. And plus the rest of the band is also there too, Queen. So they're all, but like that they would like just sing, they wouldn't listen to each other singing their verses. They had to do it, you know, like separately. And I think that also like it comes through in the song in a way that's good. Like it doesn't feel like they're in the same room having a conversation. It feels, you know, like
that really, it really shouldn't work. Like, yeah,
right. They're both like peacocking.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But it's so good. It's really, I think it's such a good song.
Something kind of struck me as you were saying this, which is that I'm not a rave person, but in this kind of like dance club atmosphere, it like, at least from the outside, it looks like the people dancing are kind of giving themselves up to the grandeur of the music, and they're allowing themselves to be a small speck on the earth, right? And this song is so big and so bombastic, and even when Sophie and Callum are dancing to it, in diegetically, right, in Turkey, it still feels like they're kind of giving themselves up to the like religiosity of this musical moment, as opposed to trying to like exert control over their own destinies, which they're both doing in different ways throughout the rest of the film, right? This is the conclusion that they've come to.
Yeah,
I think that they kind of, you know how, you know, someone mentioned, it might have been Aviv, someone mentioned Sophie is on like the cusp of being a teenager, and
yeah, Allison did that.
Oh, Allison, and
put words in my mouth.
She. It's funny because like you can kind of see her oscillating between like still being like little girl, like I love my dad, and then teenager, kind of like sullen.
He's so embarrassing.
Embarrassed, yeah.
And I'm so embarrassed, yeah. And I feel like this moment, just take everything else away. It's like they've cut the bullshit, especially Sophie, I think. Like, because Sophie's like, no, I can't, I don't want to dance. Callum has to really goad her onto the dance floor in a scene, by the way, that I kept seeing on TikTok, isolated.
Out of context.
Because as Aviv can tell you, Allison, I put off watching After Sun for a long time because I knew it was very, very, very sad. And I needed to be in like the right headspace. And So finally, I was like, oh, this is the Paul Mescal. This is the Mescal moment. Okay, okay. But point being, the like, it's like a parent and child kind of dropping the BS and just holding each other in like a moment that whose significance they can only kind of just begin to touch. And then it will become more significant. We see it, Sophie. We don't know what happens to Callum, obviously. But
yeah.
I like those moments on TV where I think Six Feet Under is a really good show for this, because everyone in that family is so repressed that they just snark at each other constantly. And they say the worst shit to each other. I don't come from a family like this, actually. But I know a lot of families can be this way, where they just say the worst stuff. And then they like come together and something meaningful happens within the moment, like the family, I don't know, in history. And then they're like, Mom, I love you. And then everything's just kind of stripped away. That's how I saw the
sitcom moment, right? Danny Tanner walks into DJ's room and is like, I'm sorry for overreacting.
I mean, in like the glossiest version of what I'm talking about, sure.
But this is the like real version of that, right? Mm-hmm. Where they do cut the bullshit.
Without words. Yeah.
And of all the moments in the rest of her life, or all the moments with her father in the rest of her life, that's the one that she wishes she could get back. That's the one that she visits in this kind of mystery hallway rave thing.
Yeah. And I think I think one of the like things that's lovely about this movie that you kind of realize as it goes along is like she, Sophie as an adult, is the same age that he was, like Callum was then, and this in this kind of memory that she's revisiting. So you can kind of see her trying in some ways, like that the kind of rave scene feels like her trying to meet him as an adult, right? Like to find this impossible place where they can see each other as adults as well, which makes the fact that he's kind of like dancing by himself, even if this is maybe in her head, you know, like there's something like even sadder about that. Like that she, if this is like her imagining him apart from her, like as he was as an adult, like he's like not reachable even then, right? Like she's holding on to him and he's dancing and looking away.
She's just replaying the tape.
Yeah, which is just like, it's so devastating. But yeah, I think, you know, to your point, Rachel, I think one of the things I also love about this movie is that you can sense the kind of fear in Callum about the fact that his daughter is about to become a teenager, right? Like he says at one point, you know, you can say anything to me, right? Like that, that kind of like classic, like he's like, he understands that she's like on the cusp of like this kind of really tumultuous period in life.
Yeah.
And he's not really sure how he's going to navigate that. And so I think like that final dance scene is so lovely because she does get to go back to being a kid again for that second, you know, like she's embarrassed at first. And he's doing like, I will say, I totally understand why this scene has been on TikTok, because Mescal does some incredibly dorky dad dance moves, like just incredible ones. He busts out every awkward move you can do. Yeah.
The tucked in t-shirt really just clinches it for me.
And the kind of smirking face. Oh, it's so good. Yeah. He's like trying his hardest to embarrass her. But yeah, like that she kind of like surrenders to being like, I can be a kid again and just dance with you is really lovely.
There's something that kind of hit me when you were talking about Sophie realizing that she's the age that Callum was when Callum, the last time she saw Callum, which weirdly reminds me of a different Christopher Nolan movie, Interstellar, right?
Oh, yeah. That's my favorite Christopher Nolan.
And I am kind of a closet Christopher Nolan, not a closet. I am a Christopher Nolan fan, but not in the way that like the bro
not
dudes
in a bad
are.
Way.
Not in a bad way. I'm not like the other guys.
I don't even care about any of that noise. I just love his big ideas.
I love his big ideas too. And it seems like there is some of the like the stuff that I really like from his earlier work, which I was inspired by as I was like starting as a filmmaker in the year 2001, is like some of this stuff where he's recontextualizing. And so it feels like the mechanics of the story are, I don't want to say inspired by or mined by, but it like, I can see a little bit of a through line between indie Christopher Nolan and his big ideas and this, which plays with time in a very different way, in a more emotional way than scientific. But it feels like those two movies are also in conversation with each other. It's like father-daughter movies.
Yeah, and kind of trying to reach across time to like meet this loved one in a different place from when you left them.
You know what they say.
Feeling abandoned. Daughter feeling abandoned.
Oh, daughter feeling abandoned. Sure. Right. Yeah. You know what they say. Love's the only thing that can transcend space and time.
Do they say that?
It's love, Tars. Love.
Love. Tars. Anytime a robot has feelings in a movie, I cry.
I have memorized that movie. I have to watch that movie at least like twice a year. I'm not kidding.
Next time you want to watch, come on down. We'll watch. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome, everyone.
Rachel and I live in the same building. I'd love to know. I'd love to learn a little bit more about the song itself, which is usually Rachel's department. So let's talk.
I mean, definitely got us on the great runway, though. I was like, I don't have to talk at all.
Not to steal your thunder.
No. I'm so happy having my thunder slit. Like I think that podcasting as an art like comes so much more naturally to Aviv because he's like a very articulate speaker. I've been told that I am articulate, but like I have to think about it, I have to like focus my energies, and then like by the end of the hour, I'm like crawl in bed. Retreat.
My favorite pastime with me and any friend group is to just yell about good things that have happened in movies or music, and we're like, oh, what about that? That was good. And then we just like go on to the next thing that was good. Yeah. And that's what I love about this podcast, because that's every episode for us. Yes.
Well, this song, it almost shouldn't have happened because they all recorded it in Switzerland, where Bowie, I think, was living at the time. So Queen and Bowie, they had it like individually booked recording sessions at Mountain Studios in Montreux. Hopefully I'm not butchering that. Montreux, Switzerland, in the summer of 81. Bowie was living in Switzerland, as I said earlier. And it sounds like Queen's recording engineer, Dave Richards, thought it might be a good idea for Bowie to stop by if he had a minute. So it was like kind of on a whim that he called him up, asked Bowie to join Queen for a session. Bowie was apparently at the studio to record vocals for Cat People, Putting Out Fire.
Hell yeah. Another great musical drop for in Inglourious Basterds.
For Paul Schrader's erotic horror movie, Cat People, which is the first I've heard of it. So anyhow, they all get in the studio. There's a lot of, shall we say, like inconsistencies. It's like everyone in the band Queen who gave quotes about it, and Bowie himself when he was still alive, they have like different memories of how the song came together. They're all kind of like saying, like attributing certain parts, lyrics included, to like another person. Like, no, Bowie, you did that. No, Freddie Mercury, like you did that. And I think the only thing that everyone could more or less agree on was that Queen bassist John Deacon really came up with that like iconic bass riff. In 99, Roger Taylor said that is the drummer Queen. Said we never actually collaborated with anyone before, so certain egos were slightly bruised along the way. So it was like this. I just picture this recording as like an all nighter where everyone's overtired and
on drugs.
Drugs, and then they're, because I did read too that they were at first just recording a bunch of covers and then decided on a whit, like, hey, let's just play and see what happens.
So are you saying
and under pressure is what happens.
This song wasn't written before Bowie got there.
Nope.
And they just kind of
made it up on the spot.
Under pressure and fuck.
Yep.
Yeah. I know. I'm like, furious. What do I usually do in a night? Nothing. How many classic songs have I written? None.
Zero.
This song does give off like a strong whiff of cocaine, which I realize is also the general era. So I would assume that that helped everyone stay up all night. So.
But not as much cocaine as Dancing in the Street, which a similar vibe, much less successful song.
It's like the most homoerotic video of all time, and I love it. I really love that video.
They're skipping down the set with their hands in each other's pockets.
Yeah. I love it.
It's great.
And I wanted to read a quote that Queen guitarist Brian May said on the Queen the Greatest series about this moment. He said, by that time, David was very impassioned and he had a vision in his head. It's quite a difficult process and somebody has to back off. And I actually did back off, which is unusual for me. So just picture these like egos bouncing off of each other, and like finally they kind of fit the right like Tetris to like they create find their the lanes. Song. Yeah. And I never knew this, but they never performed the song together while Freddie Mercury was alive. They had the opportunity to in 85 at the Live Aid show. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anyone actually broached them with the idea of performing it all together, but that was one of the only times in history after they recorded the song in 81 that they were like actually at the same place at the same time, these two huge acts. And unfortunately, they did not perform it together. And then ultimately, Bowie did perform with Queen without Freddie in 92. Nope. Yep. In 92 at Wembley Stadium. It was at the Freddie Mercury tribute concert, and Annie Lennox performed the song.
Who's got an incredible voice, not just Sweet Dreams. Annie Lennox,
yeah.
Her voice rules. It's interesting. Like, I've never tried because it's Queen and David Bowie, I just kind of assumed it was Queen. But thinking about the lyrics now, specifically, it's the terror of knowing what this world is about, feels very David Bowie,
yes.
Circa Young Americans-esque. Like,
yeah.
Like his existential ennui was really something to behold.
I think he was also like, this was like couched in like anti-Margaret Thatcher rage as well. So like very of that particular era, yeah.
Have you seen that SNL sketch about Fred Armisen leading the punk band that was like pro Margaret Thatcher?
No, I'm gonna look that like, up.
Hey, Margaret Thatcher, you're all right. It's very fun. Ian Rubbish. He plays, I think, Ian Rubbish, and I can't remember the name of the band, but it's very funny. Very funny.
That's amazing. I love that.
After Sun won several BAFTAs, a couple of awards at Cannes. Paul Mescal was nominated for an Oscar, and the movie topped critics' list all around the world, including yours, Allison. It was your number one movie of the year?
I can't remember. Top tens immediately go from my mind after I write them. They're just like,
it's up.
I really feel that.
No,
it's up there. And I think that there is this. I always try to look for like a connection, right? I'm obsessed with like wrapping it all up, bringing it all home. And I don't know if there is a connection or a thematic thing to say about this musical moment other than the idea that this song was created in one evening and encompasses the grandeur and futility of humanity and all of this like stuff about the human condition sort of feels connected to me in After Sun, where it wasn't created in an evening, but it shows such a small period of time ultimately in someone's life and how it could have these giant ripple effects. There's one moment I wanted to talk about, which is my all-time favorite moment in this film, which is there's a moment where you're watching the mini DV tape play as normally, but you just see a very, very slight reflection of adult Sophie watching herself in the past. And I think that there is this idea both in the one-nighter that created Under Pressure and the kind of more embraced theme of After Sun, where you don't really know the one night that's going to change your life and the lives of everyone around you. And that's what I think makes this such a perfectly matched music and musical and movie moment.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I think also, I mean, it's worth noting, like, Under Pressure has been on many soundtracks, right? Like,
yes.
Like this has been, like, Gross Point Blank uses it.
The Americans, I forgot.
The Girl Next Door. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, I do.
I love that movie.
A Robin Williams movie called World's Greatest Dad.
Which I also adore.
I love. It uses it so well. And I think there's this way in which, like, you think that would make it work less well, right? Like, that it is such a kind of frequent, like, thing that you reach for. But actually, I think part of that familiarity is why it's so good, you know?
Well, they almost didn't use this song for that reason, because they were worried that it would, I mean, they like, it was a placeholder, as we were talking about earlier, but they almost were like, they almost were like, we can't use this because it's associated with too many other things.
Yeah. And I think there's something about that that also matches up with that idea of excavating the past, you know, where something that you, these images that she knows, right, she remembers and that she's very familiar with, but she's looking at them again with different eyes because time has passed and it means something different to her.
Just like think, you're listening to it differently without the instruments. It's all exactly. coming together.
And I think, yeah, I think like that there is a way in which the song works with that idea of memory and like revisiting memory.
And this unflinching look, right? It's not just a quick, short, like you listen to most, if not all of the song. And so it makes you sit in all of these. It's so much about memory. It makes you sit in all of the memories that you've ever had of listening to this song. There's a delightful cover of this song by Gerard Way of My Chemical Romance and Burt McCracken of The Used that came out in 2006. God. Everyone's like, hell
yeah.
Must
have missed that.
Emo's here to stay, baby.
Yeah. I had moved on to really snobby indie rock by that point.
It's also like bold to cover this song when you're like, oh yeah, I can do Freddie Mercury and or David Bowie.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one thing that My Chemical Romance wanted to be, it was Queen.
Which reminds me suddenly of another David Bowie, not Dancing in the Street, but my personal favorite David Bowie collab with Trent Reznor. Or was it just Nine Inch Nails?
Oh, I thought you were going to say Arcade Fire.
No, I'm Afraid of Americans.
Oh, no, I don't know that song.
I think there's a needle drop of it in Showgirls, which I have not seen. But I've read about this.
Big fan of Showgirls. I watched that back to back with the documentary called Masterpiece of Shit, which I think is really, really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have a lot of hot takes on Showgirls. So if we can dig up that needle drop, we can do a Showgirls episode for sure.
Yeah, I just have this memory of I was trying to put I'm Afraid of Americans on a mix for my old English professor who was also super into music. I had like a radio show and like we would talk about music. So my farewell graduation parting gift was a mix of I'm Afraid of Americans. And I think I had to download it because this is like 2008. And the only version I could find, it like was somehow watermarked or had some like something in the file that indicated it was from the Showgirls soundtrack.
Incredible.
And that's just like stuck in my memory ever since.
But you've never seen the movie.
No.
Oh,
I
remember being like titillated by the cover, like in Hollywood the, like, video.
With
the leg. I remember thinking like this is piquing my interest in a way I don't understand. Like 10.
I'm feeling feelings and I don't like it.
Yeah.
Allison, where do you land on Showgirls?
Oh, I think Showgirls is incredible. I mean, I'm a big Verhoeven person in general, but yeah, I think it's just this movie about someone trying to eat the world, right? Like in this, in an incredible way. Yeah, I think it's like, I don't know. You know, sometimes I think people tend to take Verhoeven
literally.
Why? Yeah.
Why? I don't know. How can you watch this movie and be like, yes, this man means everything he's doing? Anyway.
I know. That was like a Starship Troopers problem as well, right? Like that people are like, oh, like he doesn't understand.
He's so pro-war.
This movie is like, right. Like this movie is very straightforward in its feelings. Yeah.
But weirdly, this brings me back to After Sun because it seems like every single person, and we did it each other to ourselves too, which is like every single person seems to have interpreted this movie correctly, right? There is no After Sun ending explained on, you know, these clickbait. And I think that's such a unique and incredible feat for a filmmaker to pull off, especially with her first film. She has produced and directed some TV before, so it's not like she just found a camera in the trash can, but yeah, it's just like such a well-crafted little movie, and little is not pejorative. Like it is a very small, quiet movie that is so perfectly put together that everyone all around the world had basically the same reaction, which I think is such an incredible piece of work.
I think it's a movie that really trusts that its viewer is going to be able to pick up all of those tiny details, you know, like that it trusts that you're going to like kind of immerse yourself in the movie and like let it carry you with its back and forth in time and with those like tiny little interactions between the two of them that tell you so much.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. You know, I think it does give you a lot while not needing to tell it, say it out loud.
Final thoughts. Showgirls versus After Sun.
I'll let you know in like 3 days. This, I know what I'm doing this weekend.
Hell yeah.
I think, you know, the world has room for both. Why not both?
Yeah. What I like a nice high, low experience.
They're both high.
Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Your work for so long. Where can people find more of you on your voice and words on the internet?
Oh yeah. This used to be an easier thing to say, but then I got locked out of my Twitter account, which I pretended I quit out of, some kind of grand stance. But it was
nice.
Largely accidental. So I'm not on there anymore. I'm on Blue Sky kind of half-heartedly. Under Allison Wilmore. And then you can find my work at Vulture under Allison Wilmore. And that's about it for me at the moment.
How many L's does Allison have?
Allison has one L and Wilmore has two L's.
It's three L's total, baby.
Three L's total, but you got to divide them up the right way. Yeah.
As a daily, I'm not kidding, daily Vulture reader and one-time writer, two-time writer. I say thank you for your service. And no, but seriously, like I kind of live and die by Vulture. Like after I watch any episode of anything, like I immediately go to the recaps.
Yeah. The recaps are, I think, like just they're so valuable. Especially now that we're all watching TV at so many different times where you're like, mm-hmm. I need the equivalent of a conversation about that episode.
Mm-hmm. And there's like a year and a half between seasons of Yellow Jackets or The Bear.
Yeah.
Or
and also I feel like now no one even knows where anything's on anymore because like they make it so difficult to know. You have no idea how long a season's gonna be. Might be 7 episodes, might be 9. They don't let you know. It's all a surprise.
There was something that I was watching where I was like, oh, this is a weird way to end the season, and it just wasn't the end of the season.
I typically look ahead at like blah blah like Yellow Jacket season 2 episodes, and I can see ahead like how many episodes I can.
Oh, it was Yellow Jackets where we thought when we were planning on doing a Yellow Jackets episode in our first season, and we were like, when is the last one? And like some websites said that there were 8 episodes, some said that were 10, and we're like, when is the season over so we can record the episode?
Yeah, it's become shockingly hard to find out what seems like very basic information.
Who knew that the golden age of television would have its downsides?
Yeah, well, I mean, half the time when you're like, oh, here's a show, and you're like, oh, it's on this streaming service you've never heard of before, right? Yeah. Yeah, so even finding things is hard.
Thank you so much. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you so much once more to our guest, Allison Wilmore. That's one L in Allison, two L's in Wilmore. We're edited by Katie Yonner, production coordinator Kyle Bosch, associate producer Lou Barron, social media producer Dale Stamfleet, executive producer Tommy West, original music by Taylor Barefoot. We are a pro Taylor podcast. In Sync is a production of Gotham West Studios. Follow us on all social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, at the In Sync Pod. And we'll see you next time.
St. Clair's Health. My community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is to support my patients as they face their mental health challenges and help them achieve their goals.
My commitment is to give my patients the care they deserve and trust so they can get back to the life and family they love.
My commitment is to be by the sides of moms and their babies on their most memorable day.
St. Clair's Health. Around the corner, ahead of the curve. St. Clair's Health. My community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is helping my cardiac rehab patients so they can live an active and fulfilling life.
My commitment is to my patients' comfort and their confidence in me with their diagnostic scans.
My commitment is to truly care for each of our emergency patients. I see them when they are most vulnerable.
St. Clair's Health, around the corner, ahead of the curve.